Dishing It Out with Gary O'Hanlon and Gareth Mullins, a Go Loud original podcast.
Your ultimate culinary companion.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us.
Welcome back to another episode of Dishing It Out with me, Gary O'Hanlon.
And me, Gareth Mullins.
And coming up on today's show, we have the brilliant Willa White. He's a madman. I've never met him before, but I'm a big fan.
I was cooking on the 6 o'clock show there a while ago, and I met him for the first time. But I actually seen him. I went to a gig, and there's a pub where I live locally in Swords, just around the corner from the house. And we were around there one Friday night, and there was a gig on. And I thought friends of ours were going up, and they had tickets with her. But oh my God, man, he is.
He's very pally with Eric Lawler. I would know Eric, kind of well, big Bose man. And I've kind of done a few bits and pieces, 6 o'clock show again, today's show possibly, but definitely 6 o'clock show with Eric over the years. And I see the two boys are usually kicking it together, you know.
Yeah, they have a podcast together, as far as I know. And I think he has a little bit of a, I mean, I'm sure he'll tell us all about it, but a little bit of a checkered past. And
does he?
I'd be interested to hear what he says about getting into, taking the road of comedy. It's such a brave thing to do.
Oh, man. Comedy. Tough life.
What? Big time.
I mean, but once you crack it, though, you're dancing, you know?
Yeah, well, look, he's going to tell us about all of that.
Should I say, you're laughing?
You're laughing. So he's coming up on the show, and I'm sure he'll have some good stories to tell us about. I was slagging you last week about pulling his vegetables from the garden and picking herbs from his balcony or every group.
Where the fuck are you from? You know what I mean? So anyway, we will have our culinary conundrums and our Nespresso recipe of the week. Do not go anywhere.
Okay, so up now we have a friend of ours, Will Alwy, a comedian. We met only for the first time fairly recently, but I think we grew up close to one another. Where are you from?
I'm the north side of Dublin, like yourself. I'm Ballymun. Only up the road.
Yeah, right, exactly. I'm Donegal. So
literally down there. We're neighbours.
Yeah, exactly. And I've been trying to get you on for weeks, and I believe you hate Donegal.
You come here. We were just saying myself and Gary beforehand, and I apologise. It's like saying to someone, isn't it, are you from Cork? And they go, no, I'm from Limerick.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. And I said to Gary, just to let the listeners get up to speed, I said, are you from Belfast? And I kind of got a bit of a look, and he went, no, I'm from Donegal. But it does sound a little bit
It does. We get that a lot, you know what I mean. It all depends. Like, you're a sound cat, low, Willa, you know what I mean. So there's boys now can ask me that with 5 or 6 pints on board and be like, fuck,
be on.
Fuck the answer off. Is the answer is different. yeah fuck you up.
What part of the, usually what they say is, yeah, what part of the north are you from, mucker or whatever it'll be, you know what I mean. Yeah, I suppose I don't get it, but I can understand, like, for anybody outside of Donegal, like, there's so many different even accents within my own house, never mind like the whole county of Donegal, like, but different parts of it, just like, we're not a million miles off Derry. I don't know, but yeah, my accent always gets picked up as being a Derry one.
And Willa, come here, what got you into the world of comedy?
The same person that got me into golf, Des Bishop.
No way.
Ah.
Yeah, so we used to play, I was good mates with Des. A lot of people would know Des is in, I'm in recovery, and I go to meetings, and Des goes to meetings, and I met Des at a meeting, and
in Ireland?
Yeah, in prison, believe it or not.
Okay.
I was in prison at the time. No golf in there, I can tell you. Well, there is a lot of stuff going in the hole, but it's not golf balls. But and Des, the whole Joy in the Hood programme that I ended up on RTE was meant to be about me initially. Oh, don't mean in the country, initially. I mean, initially.
Yeah.
And it never aspired to that. So I kind of said, look, I don't think I'd do it because I'd have been branded, you know, the ex-drug addict comedian and ex-criminal and all that. And I didn't want that kind of brand. So I said, look, if anything else comes up or there's a new television idea that you think I can get involved in, and this programme came out, Joy in the Hood, and he went into like 6 disadvantaged areas. So he went to Ballymun, was the pilot. Then he went to like Knocknaheeny and Cork. He went to Derry on the bog side.
Yeah.
He went down to Limerick. He went to the travelling community and all these things. And at the end of it then, after the 6-week stand-up comedy workshop, you're done a gig in front of the community and the people where you lived. And that's how I started doing comedy.
And was that your first gig?
That was my first gig was actually, he brought me on as a surprise in Vicar Street.
Well,
wow.
There was like a charity night on.
Jesus, what a, that's like starting your first match being a Wembley.
Did you know you wanted to be a comedian or the daft?
No, I actually, no, do you know what? I was always kind of the fella that was funny and kind of witty.
Yeah.
I was never a fighter. I was never into violence. I was never into trouble. I talked a really good fight.
Yeah.
If I told you I was going to smash your head in, you'd nearly believe it.
Mm.
But it was never that. I shied away from violence and from confrontation all the time. Like, I'm more of a lover, not a fighter. Even in school, when kids were getting bullied, I couldn't get on the bully side and bully a child. I just always had that softness to me, like to make sure that the guy was getting bullied was okay, you know. So, I never thought that I'd be a stand-up comedian. I always kind of
thought. And did he just say to you, why don't you give her a lash?
Yeah, that's what he said. So when I done the programme with him, and we then went on his tour. So all the people from the tour, well, all the ones that were half decent, he'd done a tour. So he brought each night, he'd have a different act on. So we were playing like Vicar Street. We were playing all the Cork Opera House, all these big theatres. And it was like staying in these five-star hotels, the Hayfield Manor.
Oh, wow, beautiful.
Best bowl of porridge I've ever had in my life. And staying in all these places. And then at the end of it, when the tour was over, he was like, I gotta let you hang on now, like. So we were let go into the world of comedy. Some
and
were
you straight agent? Let's get
No. Do you know what? I've never had a comedy agent.
Right.
Yeah, and it's good in a sense because you can choose in a way what you want, and you don't have to give anyone 20%.
I was going to say, like, keep your money.
You know, and I've always had bread on the table, and anyway, and I've always kind of walked. But no, I went off and started doing open spots and small gigs, and for no money. And myself and Eric Lawler, we travelled the length and breadth of the country. And then we got paid for the first time down in Cork. And that just kind of opened the door to say to other people, oh, we're not doing open spots anymore. We're getting paid now, like, you know.
Yeah.
So people had to then start paying us, you know, and it was great.
And you have more respect for you when they're paying you. And listen, were you in prison in Ireland?
Yeah, I was in prison in Ireland and I was in prison in England. So through my drug use, I ended up in prison a lot. But at the end of my drug use, I was living on the streets of London and I ended up getting extradited home from Ireland. So I went from, they put me into Brixton prison for 6 weeks to await extradition, and I waived my right to extradition because, like, when you look at it, I mean, you're talking about food, the comparisons to food in an English prison to an Irish prison is completely different. Like,
in what way?
Well, for starters, the food in an English prison ain't really great. Like, it's not great.
Right.
And I've got to say, the food in Mountjoy is decent grub.
Is it?
It really, really is.
Wow.
And they have their own bakery.
Right.
So they bake their own bread in the prison. So you get a lovely, nice, crispy kind of batch or a cob. And you'll know lads that's walking in the kitchen. And you'll know lads that's walking in the bakery. So you weren't hungry. Like, when you got your dinner as an Irish man in a prison in England that you know nobody. Like, if you're, most of the lads that are on the hot plate in Mountjoy on the wings, the lads that are locked up with you.
Right.
Yeah, so you'll get two breasts of chicken.
Yeah, they'll throw you a bit. I mean?
There's no way. You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
And you get a decent big portion of dinner.
The boys will look after you. Like.
Whereas, like, prison and the food in Brixton prison was just terrible. Like. But the grub in Mountjoy, I can honestly say, I couldn't fault it. Like, I couldn't go, the food is shit, because it's not.
Yeah.
You get the nutrients you need, you get the veg, you know, you get everything that goes.
Do you mind me asking, were you in long, like, or?
The last time I was in, I got a 5.5 year sentence, and I got a review after 3.5 years under terms and conditions that I done something about my addiction, and which I did in that
not while you were in prison, but.
No, I did. I went into detox. So I went to, I asked the prison officer for help, and I went into detox in prison. So when I asked for the help, he got me the help, and then I went to a detox unit for 6 weeks. So the first week is like a crash detox on methadone. So they bring you like from seven.
Oh, you were with heroin and stuff?
Yeah, heroin, yeah, mainly. And so they detox you. Say they start you on 50 milligrams
right.
of methadone, and it's a crash course over the 7 days, and then you go through withdrawals, and then
how was that? Horrendous.
Do you know what? I've got to say, the last time it wasn't really, really that bad. And come here, I've done it loads and loads of times before, and it's horrible,
right?
It's horrendous. But I kind of knew this time when I was doing it, because I'd start going to a couple of meetings in the main jail in prison, and I knew there was a way out, because all the other times I'd done it before, I was doing it and I'd no supports. and I had nothing to back me up and no one to help me. And it was kind of, it's like Frank Sinatra recovery, like I was doing it my way, like, do you know what I mean? There was no,
yeah,
you know what I'm saying? But I knew this time that I had a support there that I could do, and there was, you know, there was people and there was services that could help me. So I found that when I'd done it for the last time, even though, yeah, it was uncomfortable, it was rough, I didn't find it as rough as it used to be. I think because I'd really gained acceptance and I'd surrendered and went, you know what? Because I remember a fella saying to me, he said to me, this is the last time you ever have to go through withdrawals. Like, and that really resonated with me, and I went, do you know what? He's right, like.
But were you Muslim ready before? Is that part of the thing?
I don't know, but it was just too readily available. I mean, it's like if you're hanging around with six chefs, you're going to end up cooking. Mm. Do you know what I mean? Like, I know he was always hanging around with fellas that were using drugs.
Yeah.
But even if we got off drugs,
yeah,
like, the odds were stacked against me all the time.
But I've told a story on here before, but I remember when I first started chefing, the culture around drinking was mental. I mean, it was every single night that everybody was going for a reg points.
Yeah.
And I worked over in UCD, right? And I think I was 14. My brother was the head waiter. I was starting to tip into the chef world, and there was a fellow working with me. He says to me, he was making sauce, and he was like, go into the fridge there and get me two bottles of wine. And after every function, at the end of the function would be like for 600 people, they pour all the bottles of wine together and give it to the chefs, and we use it for cooking, right? Marrying it together, it's called. But it'd be all different wines into bottles, and they'd be stored into the fridge. And I walked into the fridge, and there was a waiter in there, and he was drinking a bottle of red wine in the fridge, right? And he was like, I walked in, this is the middle of the afternoon, I turned around, and your man's name was, the fish was his nickname, right? And,
right? It was Gills.
Right? I didn't even know. I called him the fish. Everyone called him the fish. And
you knew
him. I was only a young fella. I was only 15. And I walked out. I came out with the two bottles of wine and I handed it. Alan was the chef. I was like, I says, come here. I'm at the walking in there and I'm bleeding. The fish was in there and he's at the bench necking those two. And he goes, why do you think he's called the fish? And I was going, but the culture and acceptance around
in
the
kitchens. Yeah, well, I come here. I worked in Mr. Pussy's in the restaurant in Suffolk Street. I was the porter in there. And I worked in the Temple Bar Hotel as well as porter. So I've seen it. And come here, when you're a porter, you're at the lowest end of it. But you're still very important.
Oh, Jesus. You're the most important in the kitchen.
Clean pots and they need plates and clean cutlery. But I seen it. I seen the drink culture and I seen the drug culture in the kitchen. And in fact, the guy that I worked with in that kitchen ended up getting murdered a good few years ago.
Stop.
It was for stuff, drug related kind of stuff as well, yeah.
I mean,
so it's
what
the kitchen. Chefs. A lot of them are not regarded.
Is it?
Yeah, well, what I was going to say was, like, as my career progressed, I made a decision very quickly that I needed to get into the best kitchen I could get myself into. And when you get into better kitchens,
that's only in McDonald's now.
Yeah, exactly. But you like the culture change because you're going into a really professional environment. Everyone has gone out for a few points, but only at the weekend. Mm. And I definitely noticed. I kind of made the decision that I'm not going to go drinking every night after work.
Yeah.
And because I knew I could see so many people slipping into that, you know.
Well, you think about it, Garrett. Right? You think of the pressure that you're under.
Yeah.
Like like the stress, the pressure, the orders are building up. You're trying to get it out. You're banging the bell. You're getting the dishes out. There's more coming in. And come here, I eat a lot. I'm not going to name the pub in a pub in Swords, and it's ran like a fine tuned machine.
Mm.
It's the only way to say it.
Right.
And I've never went in once and got bad food in the place. Now come here, and in saying that, if I did go in once and get bad food, I will always give people the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I'll always say, well, look, come here. You know, but I think if it's continuous, you kind of go, well, you know, and they're the ones that's going to lose the custom, like. The likes of
where is it in Swords? I live in Swords.
It's the old school.
It's very good.
Yeah, and come here.
Very
and
good.
Not only that, like, and you'd know, Garrett, staff.
Yeah, sound.
Like, Willie owned the lads that walk in there and the girls on the floor.
Yeah.
It's orchestrated.
Yeah,
it's the only way to.
Busy.
So you do any cooking yourself? Well, I know.
I'm actually not bad.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm all right.
You dabble.
I do a small bit. Now, I What would a cuke? I'd cuke a roast dinner.
I'd
done the Christmas dinner this year for 17 people.
Oh, Jesus.
Me missus kind of jumped in and done it. Now, me missus is a really good cook.
Yeah.
But I can cook. Nothing kind of too fancy. Like, I pasta, spaghetti bolognese. Yeah. I love pork. I don't know.
So do I.
Yeah. Do you know what? So I'm a...
Underrated.
A butcher boy, try it.
Are you?
Yeah.
That was cool. Is that what you went into?
Well, that's when I went to live in London when I was 16 years of age. You saved me time as a butcher over there. Yeah, I worked for an Irish company called Corrigan's. Come here, and I like... Me missus doesn't like cooking lamb. For some reason, I love lamb.
So many people have that
relationship. Yeah, it's a smell or something.
I like a shoulder of boned and rolled pork because there's a nice juices in it.
Yeah.
And come here... And for a family that aren't flash, it's a nice roast dinner.
Yeah.
It's not mad expensive.
No.
Yeah.
It's cheaper than lamb, it's cheaper than beef.
Oh, big time.
Do you know what I'm saying?
Pork is amazing.
Oh, come here, and you get the crackling on.
Oh, yeah. It's all about the crackling.
Isn't it?
Oh.
Yeah.
Get the crackling right, you're home dry.
Would you ever get a roast when you're in the joy?
Yeah, you would, yeah. Yeah, you get a roast. They give you a roast beef and that, yeah. Give you a roast chicken.
Yeah,
you get a fry on Christmas morning.
That pork.
One day of the year, you get a fry up, yeah.
Oh, do you?
That's it.
Christmas morning. Yeah. Sausages and pudding, the whole
works. You'd be hoping not to be in for
it. Yeah. Well, there's a bit of that, too. But if you're there, at least there's something to look forward to.
Yeah.
That porchetta we had at the Eurotux thing a few weeks ago was deadly. Were you at that?
Oh,
were you not there?
Fucking, you don't remember. It was only a couple of weeks ago.
So, Gary, here's a question for you.
We had a lovely Dan at Tulfaris.
Here's a question.
Beautiful.
Tulfaris is lovely.
Yeah.
That golf course. Never played it.
I never played it. We could have played it that day, but I was working. I just popped over for an hour. But we had a lovely, just when you say pork, like that's he did a lovely porchetta, which is where you keep the belly on the loin and you wrap the whole thing. It was as good as I ever had.
Listen, I'm talking about food. If you were on that row, what would your last meal be?
Well, that's a question. That's a question we ask at the end.
Oh, is it?
Yeah. So thanks for ruining the fucking show. Good man.
Nice to know you listen to the podcast.
Yeah.
Put that out.
Yeah. It's good to know. It's good to know you tune in every week, will it?
An avid fan.
Never miss an episode.
Yeah. I love you, boys.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So we'll hold off.
Joke, I'm a comedian.
Yeah. So we'll hold off on the death row dinner.
I've seen you in Peacocks. Good few years ago, upstairs in Peacocks.
I was only in there a few months ago as well.
Doing a gig.
A great comedy night in there.
Yeah, yeah.
And I have to say about Peacocks as well, where we're on the subject, they've upped their game on the field.
Yeah. Big time.
They really, really have.
Like, if you ever tuned into the show, what we talk about all the time is the standard of food in Ireland has gone up, and you travel around.
Yeah, I do.
Do you feel that like the good is changing?
But you're him and Burnaby in and out of fucking
Avoca
scoffing it.
We're actually out this week. Do you know what? I think you have to up your game.
Yeah.
I think the way it is, I think the food.
That's very funny, by the way, when the two of you start, you just come out after a fucking fancy lunch.
Well, I'll tell you how that happened, Gary.
I guarantee if you two boys keep doing that,
you'll end up
getting a gig.
So this is what happened, right? It started, like many things, and it started by a fluke.
Yeah.
Me and Jason was out in we were out in Portmarnock and we were having a walk, and he says, do you want to go in here and get a coffee? And we'll get the E. Not a bother. We walks in, the place is half empty. There's about 12 empty tables. I says to the fella front of the house on the desk, I says, can we grab a table? I says, we're just going to get a bit of breakfast and we're going to go. We're not hanging around. Have you a booking? He says, mate, it's a cafe. What do you mean? Because it is. It's a glammed up place.
Yeah.
I said, no, we haven't got a booking. I said, but we're just going to have the food and we're going to go.
Yeah.
Oh, no, you just can't sit in.
You're joking.
I said, can we get a takeaway? He says, yeah, no bother. So we went to the counter and we're standing there. I ordered a sandwich and Jason ordered something else and I ordered an Americano and that. We were waiting about 25 minutes. Then we sat down at a table while you were waiting because we were standing that long.
Yeah.
There was no one there. Your man comes over, he goes, you're going to have to go from there. There's someone going to be sitting down there in a minute.
Stop.
Still, when we went, there was nobody there. 25 minutes later, I'm waiting on a sandwich. Jason's waiting on something thing. And I says to the fella, I says, is there any sign of the sandwich? I says, what, nearly 25 minutes here? He said, oh, did you not get them? And I went, no. I said, I'm sure if I'd a girl, I would have bleeding known. Like, or he said, I gave it to the fella on the desk. I says, well, he didn't fucking order it. So what are you giving it to him for? So your man had the stuff at the desk and he gave us it.
You are joking.
He says, swear to God. And Jason walked outside and he goes, fuck them. He took out his camera and that was it. Come here. So it started from that.
Did you start bringing your man in after?
Yeah, I started bringing my man the one out. And my man actually is at home on a shelf, or Ash is at home.
I've missed that.
Yeah, I'm gonna bring her with me.
You're bringing an urn, like I brought my man. Ah, for fuck's sake.
So we have a tea cosy, but we brought Jason's dad the last time, which is a bit of clay out again. But I have to say, Jason is a really good friend of mine, but he's so funny.
He's really,
really funny, like.
Yeah.
And he's 30 years now on this.
Yeah.
Well,
he's gone to Edinburgh this year. He's the biggest selling ticket in Edinburgh probably the last 5 years.
Wow.
Yeah, he sells out every night.
Wow.
Have you done any of that? Have you done Edinburgh?
I've done, no, I haven't done.
Would you like to?
No, the run doesn't appeal to me. The month doesn't do anything for me. I took a play there for a couple of weeks. I've gigged there. I've done like in the Stan Comedy Club, the Best of Irish, or I've jumped on late and live, or I've done a couple of gigs here and there. But the whole run of the month doesn't. I've seen so many really good comedians standing at arrivals in Dublin Airport, broken men and women, after doing a month in Edinburgh.
Really?
It doesn't appeal to me.
Is the crowd harsh?
You see, if you're going over there, it doesn't really matter how much, Gary, that you were established back here or what you've done back here. No one knows you over there.
Yeah.
You've gone into a completely different pond. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And even to sell tickets, they have to know who you are.
Yeah.
So most comedians going over first do the free fringe. So people come in for nothing.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
And yeah. You can test your material and see if it's going
to
work.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you wouldn't. You'd need to have an hour solid going there. You need to have a show.
Wow. So
you couldn't be just going in and trying to wing it over there, like, you know? So it's free in. Like I was saying to Eric, I says it's free in, but it's tenner to get out, like.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? If there is a... you all run over this hour after 5 minutes.
Does your comedy translate, do you think, when you go away?
Yeah, it does. My stuff would be universal enough, and it's always good to have local knowledge about areas in Edinburgh where... And I've eaten in some really nice... Well, mind you, I got food poisoning in Edinburgh.
Oh, lovely.
In a seafood restaurant. What did I
There's restaurants must love seeing you coming in, don't they?
I was just going to say, yeah.
Here,
walking, yeah. You see Willa coming, dust yourself down.
Two places I got food poison was with seafood. One was in Lynch, and the second place was in Edinburgh. I don't know if you've ever had food poison.
No, once. Chinese in Galway.
I really, really, really thought I was going to die, like.
Yeah.
It was that bad.
It's shocking.
Yeah, and it's always seafood. Well, it was for me the two times. Yeah. Shellfish.
Yeah.
Clams.
And you'll remember that one.
Oh, yeah.
That's the king. That's the Mac Daddy of food poisoning, shellfish.
Yeah.
If you come out of that.
People have died from
And
there's no cure for it.
No.
You just got to let it ride its course.
Hold on.
Yeah.
Just get a full family pack of fucking toilet roll and away you go and hope for the best.
You need, when you're getting your bathroom fitted in your house, that the sink is under your chin where you're sitting on the jacks.
If you get one of them New York bathrooms,
it comes out about ends of you, like.
Yeah, for sure.
It's kind of like seasickness. What did he say? They say with seasickness, on the first day you think you're dying, and on the second day you really think you're dying. We went to Clare Island. You know Clare Island?
Yeah.
So there's a hostel on Clare Island, and when we went in, the chef, I swear to God, was out the back holding his chest with a waiter. They were waiting on a helicopter. He was out there taking a heart attack. And there was obviously
there was another
chef in there, but it was in a hostel, and it was the nicest food I've ever eaten out of a hostel in my life.
Wow.
It had like a kitchen in it, and they done steak and they done seafood chowder. I love a bowl of chowder.
Yeah,
Holt the tram place. You ever go to the little market?
Oh yeah.
He does a great bowl of chowder.
What did grub look like for you growing up?
Mince.
No, do you know what the grub like?
Was it a big part of the house? Like, have you many siblings?
No, and my mum, to be honest with me, my mother got, and God be good with her, and she want, my mum was a black belt at cooking, like one of her chops would fucking kill you. She wasn't great. She'd boil water.
Really?
Do you know what I'm saying? Like, she wasn't a great cook. And it was one dish for everybody. There was none of this like the kids nowadays, you know, three. Like my missus had put on something for me and do something for you know, and I'm going, that like that never happened.
That's alien to us as like, well,
Like, it was like meat and two veg in our house.
Yeah. And eat it or you're failed.
And a lot of offal. And I love offal. I love kidneys. I love liver.
I love liver.
I love ox heart. I love stuffed lamb's hearts. I like all that stuff. Tripe.
Yeah.
I'd eat a bit of tripe as well.
We had food critic Katie McGuinness in last week, and she was saying that tripe is one of only two or three things that she just cannot stomach at all.
Stomach.
Yeah.
Boom, boom. Well, I walked for Larry Goodman up in the AIBP.
Yeah, AIBP, yeah.
So I've seen it from field.
From a source.
Saving your time as a butcher.
No, it was before. I was actually walking there before I went to London, and it just happened that when I went to North London, one of my mates was walking in a butcher shop.
Wow.
And when I wasn't walking Monday to Friday, I used to go in there for Saturday because your man used to give us cash. And the fella that was running the butcher shop was from a little butcher shop called Farrelly's up in Hanlon's Corner, and they used to own the towel and the old cattle market. That's right. What his father done, and they used to slaughter, because back then in Dublin in the 70s and 80s there was a lot of piggeries all around the city. There was loads, and there's none no more. Most of them are all like old stables up around Vicar Street, all around them areas. They were old piggeries. But he was there, he was a Dublin fella, and he was a really, really nice bloke, and me and him just kind of clicked. And he said to me, would you not come and save your time? He says, I'll look after you. He said, I'll give you more than what a normal first-year apprentice will get.
Yeah.
And then I found out that he had horses, and I loved horses. So this fellow was a recovering gambler. He's a guy called Matt Farrelly, his name was. So I used to get a half day of a Wednesday, and I used to get a day off on a Sunday, obviously, because we weren't walking. And I used to go out with him, and he had Arab race horses.
Wow.
And we used to go out riding our horses with him, and he was just like a real kind of father figure to me, and just a really good bloke.
Nice.
But his missus was and I'm still in touch with her. She's moved back to camp. She was an amazing cook.
Wow.
So you'd go out and he'd get a big lump of beef, like, and she'd do it with all the trimmings and the come here. It was like home from home.
Yeah. It's nice that, actually. Yeah, good memories.
Yeah, really fond memories of him, you know. And I still stay in touch with her. And I had loads of family in London and that.
Yeah.
But a lot of time I just kind of kept to myself, like, you know.
Yeah.
What was the reason for you going to London?
Work, just.
Well, there was nothing here. I went to London when I was 16 years of age.
Was that the 80s?
On a boat, like, yeah.
90s, 80s.
Yeah, 89. And there was loads from... There was loads from the north.
Big time.
And a lot of joyriders from Belfast that were just had to get out of Belfast.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Just went to London, like.
Yeah.
You know, and it was a great place at the time. But for a young lad like me, I was kind of, you know, I had a job. Obviously, the place I lived in a squat in Manor House there in just beside Finsbury Park. And a lot of the lads was into drugs. A couple of them OD'd. A couple of them got sent home in coffins. And then I just kind of moved down to Hackney. Then I got a little place down in East 8 down there in Median Road. And then after about three and a half years, I ended up in a psychiatric hospital. I went off my head and ended up in that for 7 months. And just loads of circumstances, events that kind of just rolled out. Like, you know, life just takes turns. I suppose when you've no guidance and you're on your own and you think, like most teenagers, you know, we always say, get yourself a teenager while you can, because he know everything, like, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
We can't be at the spot of Google. He knows everything, like. Well, you think you know the way.
You do
the
think
world,
you know,
and
yeah.
You don't.
No.
And it's only when you look back now.
I know, but
you know,
that's
as
the problem.
An adult, you say, I actually haven't got a clue, like.
Is that whenever you started using then at that
stage? Yeah, yeah, yeah. The wheels just kind of fell off after that. But I was always taking a substance. I grew up in a home, like, and there was a lot of domestic violence going on with my father. My father came from generational trauma with his own father. There were 16 in my dad's family.
Okay.
And a year between every one of them. So my granny was pregnant for 16 years. Like, it's mad when you think about it.
Yeah, yeah.
And they literally had nothing. Like my dad.
No telly in anyway.
No, well, definitely not. I think if you'd had a telly,
they'd probably need a telly.
I think it's. Yeah. But they literally, like, I spoke to me uncle over in London, and he was telling me they were sleeping on straw. Like, they'd no bedding. They were that poor. They were eating out of bins in the fruit markets, the Corporation Fruit Markets. You know, the Brazen Head pub.
Yeah.
But my family is from that little block of flats just across the road, in behind the merchant
wouldn't
there.
Yeah. Up there now with all the.
No, you wouldn't.
You drove up there the other day.
Yeah, but they hadn't got a thing. Like, so there was a lot of stuff going on at home, and it was just a great escape for me to kind of get away from what was going on. Like, I had no way of dealing with
He didn't know no different.
He dealt with as a young man, and all he knew was drink and violence. And unfortunately, a lot of the time, my mother, God be good to her, was on the receiving end of it, and my sister would get a baiting every now and again as well. Sometimes in cars, and sometimes you wouldn't know what you were getting it for. And you've also got to remember that I went to school. I don't mean to sound ancient, but I'm actually 55 tomorrow, like, you know.
Oh.
But in 1982, corporal punishment stopped. So I was in school while corporal punishment was going on. So I was getting beaten in school and told I was stupid. And then I was going home and I was getting beaten at home and told I was stupid. Do you know what I mean? There was no love and affection. And I'm not here saying, give me the fucking...
Yeah.
I mean, there was lads that were a lot more worse off than me.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And had it an awful lot more worse. But I mean, what do you do? Like, you just... I couldn't wait till I got that age. I left school with no qualifications, no education. So I had nothing to kind of...
Jumped on the boat.
And my dad had a good job. My dad worked for Telecom Ireland at the time. Or Post and Telegraph. So he had a decent job.
Mm.
But I mean, I couldn't get in without having exams or having stuff like that. So... Everyone was going to London.
Yeah.
So it was like follow the pack. It's like the fella that got the tattoo of individual on his forehead. Do you ever hear that? And his dad says to him, why'd you get that done? He says, because all my mates have it done. Do you know what I mean? So I was just following the pack, and I just went to London with them. And come here, in the beginning it was brilliant, but unfortunately at the end of it was kind of a rock that I perished.
Yeah, but you're like, all that's in your mind, you know, it's in the back of your subconscious or whatever. Like it's hard to fucking, Jesus, that's tough. Yeah.
Well, at the end of my using, I come into recovery at 29 years of age, but at 28 years of age, I done a short video in Mountjoy Prison, and I'm just going to show you, and this is what I looked like. Now, I'd love to get back to this weight if I could, but look at,
jeez.
No way, man. Is that you? That doesn't even look like the same person, does it?
No. You look better.
Yeah.
Bigger.
Yeah.
I didn't know what word to use there.
Are you sure the food was good? Are you sure the food was good? You look like something out of Aldrich's.
You definitely only got a fry once a year.
Yeah. Well, no, that was, come here, you know, that was just the way it was. And fortunately enough, then when I cleaned me act up and got me shit together, I righted a lot of me wrongs and stuff that I'd done in the past.
Yeah. Good for you, man.
And luckily enough for me,
look, you look fucking great, Willa.
I think that when you get older, I think the body just gets old.
Yeah,
I think the mind.
Okay.
Kind of, you keep yourself. Kind of,
well, I'm 47 and like I'm 48 in a couple of weeks. Like, I don't be thinking any different than when I was 21, you know. There's like, I often say to my older brother or Kevin, the younger brother with Chanton, it's like, oh, geez, I wonder when we're like 60 or 70 or 80, am I still going to want to jump on a motorbike and fucking tear it down the road as hard as I can go, or jump in a Mustang and drift it as like. Really, I'm just like going, like, I can't see a day like where I won't want to. To do, I mean, the body mightn't be able to hold it or whatever, but
no, you do.
It's
you
have still that. Like,
look, I have an old, I have an old E36 convertible, and I love the car.
Yeah.
Mrs. went away Sunday night, and I was just kind of home alone, and I went out to Hout. I went and had a thing of chowder. His prices has gone up as well, and I said it to him.
Yeah.
He says, I remember coming out here when he was in a van on the pier, and it was £6 for a thing. It's £10.90 now, like.
Yeah.
And come here, inflation is great if your wages has gone up.
Yeah.
But I mean, when everything has gone up and your money ain't.
Yeah.
I mean, living not just easy. Becomes a little bit harder. But I took a drive out in the car, and I have the roof down, and I'm looking like that typical wanker.
Yeah.
I'd look at.
Well, I'll tell you now.
Go, do you know what I mean?
You're fucking rolling out there in a Beamer convertible. scoffing about the price of a bowl of chowder. Shove it up your fucking hole, will you? Fucking poor bastard's trying to make
it's
a fucking.
There's
only a fucking teller for a bowl of chowder. Stay out of the out of the fucking K Club, you prick. I can tell you now. Fucking yeah, tenner.
Stick to Salon Park.
If you want a slice of Guinness bread with it, it'll be a fucking tenner.
You can't wait till you walk in.
This fucker rolling in on a fucking convertible Beamer. €10 for a bowl of cheddar. Fuck you. Do you know what I mean?
£60 worth of petrol.
To get there. The cheek of this fucker. That's everything anyway, is fucking wrong with patties.
You started telling us.
I met me mansion now. There's no pee here.
No, exactly.
Oh, what?
The last question, which you've already figured out, is if you had a debt row meal, what would it be?
Yeah, a cheap bowl of cheddar somewhere.
€6 a bowl of cheddar.
I'd write would the price
wherever you want
start a main thing.
Well, you don't even need to pay for it, so you can eat whatever the fuck you want wherever you want.
So for starter, I'd have scallops.
Yeah,
nice scallops. Yeah.
Oh, aye.
With a black pudding probably as well.
Yeah,
thrown in there. Yeah.
Yeah.
And for me main course, and it's just something that we used to eat growing up, and I used to love it. And me dad, it always reminds me of me dad, and I still eat it every now and again. I'd have a couple of nice lime pork chops with the kidney on them. Really nice mashed potatoes. And I'd have the rind on the pork chop as well.
Oh, yeah.
Some really nice mashed potatoes and some beans.
Lovely.
Baked beans. And then for main course.
Dessert.
Dessert would have to be bread and butter pudding.
Oh, yeah.
And a big, huge glass of Bleeding Club Orange.
Do you get dessert in the joy?
Yeah, you do, yeah.
Yeah, every day?
Every day, yeah.
Some spot?
Yeah. I don't know what you're missing. I'm always looking for a good check. If you have any phone numbers, let them know.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I know it's dead.
What would you have? Or is yours?
Yeah, a duck confit. To start? Oh, yeah. It's just the greatest.
I love duck.
Yeah. Duck confit's one of the greatest things man ever came up with.
I watched this duck confit dish with beetroots. I've eaten it a couple of times.
Yeah.
Do you know I've never had duck confit?
The leg is slow cooked in duck
fat. You cook it in its own fat. You cook it in duck fat.
Right.
Yeah, with a little bit of garlic. But I cure it. So I rub it with a Maldon rock salt.
I thought you were going to bring it to Lourdes or something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, you rub it with Maldon rock salt, and I squeeze in one star anise, one fresh tarragon, and then I sandwich it between two slices of orange. I cure it for 24 hours, take off the orange and brush off the excess salt. It's usually soaked in, and that's what you want. It seeps right into the meat. And then you melt your duck fat, you pour it over, so you completely cover it with fat.
It's running down me.
Yeah. And then,
like Pavlov's dog sitting here.
On a really low oven, around 140, 150, depending on your oven, with no fan, you want to just confit it then for about 3 hours. It all depends, until you just press the meat and it's absolutely just about. It's just standing yellow.
Like pork and all that, you would absolutely love that.
Yeah, and then you just brush the skin then with a little bit of honey. And under a salamander to get it really crisp, so that the fat's just totally crackling on a pork. You get the fat really crispy, so all the gelatinous fat's completely rendered out of it. And then I do it with a little beetroot, wild mushroom, and a little sherry tarragon cream sauce. And it is out of this world. It's beautiful, yeah.
Do you know what my granny used to make? A lovely apple dumpling.
Right.
It was like a pudding,
and custard,
was it?
Yeah, it was bleeding gorgeous.
Yeah, deadly.
Right, let's have you, Gareth. What would you have?
I'd have lobster to start.
Oh, would you?
Look at you, two pricks from the north side of Dublin. Scallops and lobster up the yin yang.
A mate of mine that's a chef, and he's walked in the ice house. You know the ice house?
Yeah. Mm.
Sosso, his name is.
Yeah.
And I met him in Swords a few months ago, and he had a bag of three lobsters in it live.
Yeah.
And he come up to the house. I'll show you the pictures of the dish. I'll have them on the phone there. And he done a lobster brisk.
Oh, fire up in the house.
Oh, Jesus.
Unbelievable.
Christ. And he done a pasta dish, and he done bread and butter pudding.
Yeah.
You knew he was coming up.
Oh, I knew. He's
didn't
a
just
really
find him
mate.
In the street.
This boy has walked in some of the really nicest restaurants in the world, and he's a great fella as well. But I tell you, he comes into the kitchen and he cukes. When he's in someone's house, he cukes in his socks. just takes his shoes off,
yeah,
and he gets grounded in the kitchen. But to, just to watch him cook, work, it's just, it's effortless.
Deadly.
Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. And I've looked at chefs over the years in kitchens and that, and it's like the panache in it. Like, it's not, there's never anyone doing any of that.
It's not any tradesperson, but I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a beauty in it, isn't
it? Yeah, no, for sure. Anyone that works in the world of craft, whether it's a butcher or, you know, a fucking good bricklayer.
Yeah,
or,
it looks effortless.
Yeah, yeah. No.
You know, what I call it, the Messi effect. Like, is, like, I have a brilliant chef now at the minute, but he's running fast. And I was like going, but he's a football fanatic. And I was like going, I won't say his name, but a brilliant guy, brilliant. And I just said, do you ever see Messi running or Scholesy back in the day? I goes, no. I goes, controlled, steady, slow down.
Steady wins a race.
Yeah, slow and steady wins a race. You know what I mean? Like, and
he gets a fella shouting at them all the time. That keeps running around the place.
No.
So do you know where are you on Christmas Eve? I'm very fortunate. I have a mate of mine that lives in LA, and he's a successful fella. He has a business and that. He went over with nothing. He went over with a few grand and lived in garages and sofa soft and the whole lot. But he done all right for himself. But his cousin is the manager of the Beverly Hills Hotel.
Oh, wow.
So we booked ourselves in for dinner on Christmas Eve.
No way.
We went down. A joy the photos out there. So I'm like, so the table, it's all of them are there, you know, all different. So at our table, you've got me from Ballymun, me missus from Kilbarrick, me mate Terry is from Clondalkin, his missus is Mexican, his son is Mexican, and then you've got a fella from Darndale, right? Who's a techie guy who looks the most, he doesn't look like he's ever been in Darndale in his life. And his partner is my mate's sister, and she's from Clondalkin. And we are having a laugh.
And you so tore up the playing. Beverly Hills.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Better you're playing the piano, and I'm saying to your man, will you play Maniac 2000? Here's your man, sorry, sir. Said, Maniac 2000. I don't know that, sir. And we had a laugh, and we were all there laughing, but it was a set menu. And the menu was, and my missus went in and she picked up the sheet and she looks at me and she goes, for fuck's sake.
Oh, yeah.
I says, what? She goes, it's €375 for a set menu.
Mm.
And I said, listen, we are never going to do this.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
For a set, it's Christmas.
Yeah.
He says,
into the neck.
And did you enjoy it?
And if it was gorgeous. The chef came out to us after.
Yeah.
No way.
And I looked at the chef's watch, he had a Rolex on him.
Oh,
he's an English lad.
Yeah.
And he came out, and the fella that's the young lad, the head waiter that served us, was from Selbridge. And he had a great, I mean, do you know what? We had a great night. We had a great.
Yeah, it's one you'll remember forever.
And we may paid for the whole lot of us
happy
as well,
days.
Which made it an awful lot more better. But the food was outstanding. It was everything. It was the experience of it.
Yeah.
It was from when you went in, your chair being pulled out, the waiters, the way
right
the
down
whole
to your mate paying the bill.
Exactly. Yeah, it was. It was the best part.
Yeah,
exactly. And come here. I'll probably never ever do that again.
Yeah.
But you know what? Life is for living. Like,
said it.
Yeah. Look at, as my dad used to say, God be good to him. He says, there's no tow bars on the back of our hair.
No.
We're not bringing that with you.
Well, yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Spend the while it's there.
Well, listen, Willa, it's been brilliant having you in, man. You're a legend.
Thanks,
I know.
Thanks so much for having us.
Yeah.
To jump in right
top drawer. Cheers, mate.
Time for an Nespresso Professional break. Brought to you by Nespresso Professional. Effortless moments, exceptional coffee.
Time now for an Espresso Professional break as we serve up this week's dish of the week. So what have you got for us today?
Do you know, I've been thinking about this slot for a while, and I'm just going to talk about a little bit of a skill rather than an exact recipe. So, because somebody asked me in the restaurant the other day what I liked cooking the most. And that's the type of thing you answer when whatever mood you're in, right? But they said to me, oh, I'd really love to cook fish more, but I just find it too intimidating. And I said to them, like, if anything, you should be more nervous of cooking meat, because there's much more things that can go wrong with meat. Like, it can be tough, you can't rest it correctly, you can undercook it depending on what type of protein. But with fish, most fish you can eat raw. I mean, there's only a couple that you can undercook. So I was like, the thing I would just say is, if you're cooking a piece of fish skin on, so if it's a piece of sea bass or a piece of sea bream or sea trout or salmon, get yourself a non-stick pan. And this is going to sound a bit mad, but if you can buy yourself a small little non-stick pan that's only for cooking fish, it's a good idea, and keep it for that. And then have another pan that you cook your meat and all in.
I have one that I only use for eggs.
Yeah, exactly. I have one for eggs, I've one for fish, and then I've the ones that I get cranking, yeah, roasting meat. But if you have a little egg pan at home and one for fish, and then get your fish from your fishmonger or your supermarket, bring it home, take it out of the fridge, piece of kitchen towel, dry the skin really well to remove any moisture.
Essential.
Yeah, like, and that's, it's such a little thing that we just do.
When you know, you know.
Exactly, when you know, you know. Stick your pan on, you want to get it on a medium heat, little bit of vegetable oil in the pan, then season your fish with a little bit of salt, and then you place it into the pan away from yourself. You can see what I'm doing, but you drop the fish in and you push it away from yourself. You know why, Gary, if you put it in the other way, you're going to smash
a bubble on your
face onto yourself, where if you put it away from yourself, the oil will splash up onto your backsplash that's in front of your stove, and that's what it's there for. And then when it's in the pan, don't touch it, leave it alone, because you need that caramelization of the skin to start. A mistake you see a lot of commie chefs or people that are new, they start pushing it around the pan, they create cold spots, the skin hasn't got time to caramelize, it sticks and it tears. It's a sinking feeling when that happens. So yeah, if you just put the fish in, skin side down, let it start to caramelize, put the other piece in beside it, let that
take one step back from the pan.
If you just give the pan a little wriggle, if the fish doesn't want to slide, it's not ready to turn.
Yeah.
So then once you see it starting to want to move a little bit, take a spatula, offer the spatula in under the skin, it'll be totally free then, and you're golden. You're going to cook it 3/4 of the way on skin sides, turn it over, turn the pan off, throw in a knob of butter, let the butter melt, nap it over or spoon it up over the top of the fish, squeeze a lemon. That's it. That's as simple as it gets. Yeah. And I think if you learn that technique, you will, if you've learned anything from listening to this show, that's it. And it's really that simple. And try not, and come here, look, if the skin sticks, no drama. Most of the time, nothing to worry about. Cook the fish that it's cooked through. Get yourself a little temperature probably if you want. You can cook it that it's a little bit under, if it's sea bream, sea bass, sea trout, salmon.
Now, I'm always saying, like, you know, it's all about trial and error.
Yeah, learn, I mean, exactly.
Like, if you find that when you cut into it, then it's a tiny wee bit under. Obviously, if you have a thicker piece like salmon,
yeah, it takes a bit longer.
You might have to stick it in the oven for a few minutes, like for maybe 6 minutes at 170 or whatever, and cook it through.
If I was cooking for 8 people and I was doing a piece of sea trout or a piece of salmon, I'd cook them 2 at a time in that pan. I'd have a little tray with some parchment paper beside me. I'd have the oven preheated to 180 degrees. When I take the piece of fish off, it would be crispy skin side up on the tray, and I'd put the 8 pieces crispy skin side up. If you want, you could put a little knob of butter on the top of each of them, and then pop them into that preheated oven for 6 or 8 minutes just before you want to eat, and then take it out, perfectly cooked fish. And honestly, there's nothing better than a piece of fish cooked well, seasoned. Last week we got a question about what you should be feeding your kids with pasta. Piece of roasted fish like that with a little bit of spaghetti or some penne that's dressed with a little bit of butter.
That's fish is beautiful, pan-fried. We used to go catching rainbow trout when we were younger, you know, with the oil boy or even our grandfather, and then come back, just pull the head of them and gut them and pan season them, pan-fry them.
Nothing better.
In butter. Oh, man.
Lethal. That's living. Yeah, yeah.
And then you'd be eating half a loaf to get the bones out of your throat.
Yeah.
You
know?
Well, you haven't lived until you get a fish bone off out of your throat with a slice at the baker's.
Okay, so all those people that I was talking about nervous about cutting fish, just ignore what he said there, right? So ask your fishmonger to pin bone whatever it is that you're cooking if you're not confident enough to do it yourself.
Thanks again to Nespresso Professional for sponsoring this part of the show. To find the right coffee solution for your workplace, head to nespressoforbusiness.co.uk.
So up now we have the bit of the show where we hear from you. Aoife, have we any conundrums?
We do indeed, and you might have to help me with my pronunciation on this one. So we've one here from Laura, and it says, I'm trying to teach myself some basic cooking skills at home to level up in the kitchen, and I've been trying to implement the mise en place.
There you go.
Beautiful. Is that how you say it?
Yeah.
Practice, but I find it's adding so much more time to my dishes. Is this something you do at home yourself, or is it purely for the professional kitchens? I'm wondering if I could even meal prep some ingredients at the start of the week. Would love your thoughts and any other advice you have for cooking at home.
I think maybe mise en place just basically means getting everything ready. It means everything in place. So everybody that ever cooks does mise en place without knowing it. So if you're going to make a bolognese, right, the mise en place for bolognese would be like what Gary always talks about, sofrito. So it would be onions, celery, carrots, garlic. And the mise en place of that would be having your mince ready, having all your vegetables chopped, having your herbs there, your bottle of wine, your tin of passata, it'll all be ready before you start. So it just means everything is ready. So
I'm kind of thinking that it might be someone who might be chopping the onion while something else has already started cooking, or, you know, maybe that's where it's adding more
time. Yeah, and really, like, if you're doing something like, just because I said it, a bolognese there, you might start off by browning the mince, and while the mince is browning, you could do all the other things. So really, that it's a word that doesn't really happen at home, isn't it, Gar? Like a mise en place, it's just really... Yeah.
You're doing it, you're just not labelling it.
Yeah, exactly. But I suppose we've spoke loads of times about when you're entertaining, your mise en place is getting everything ready before everybody arrives.
Okay.
So like what that girl needs to be thinking about is that she just needs to get everything ready, and don't be over focusing on it really. Like in a restaurant scenario, your mise en place is your steaks are cut in the fridge. If you have a potato gratin, it's cooked already, it's cut into squares, and then you're heating it. Your chips are already cut into chips that might be blanched. That's what mise en place is. So
yeah,
it just means everything in place.
So as she asked there about, you know, prepping at the start of the week, you probably could, for 3 days, have some of your veg chopped in the fridge in a container.
It'd probably be a little bit excessive.
The likes of that's probably a wee bit excessive, yeah. Like meal prep, really... Where that's helpful is if like you have a quiet Sunday evening or whatever, and you wanted to make a chicken curry and you made a lasagna and whatever, and then you cooked it and you let it cool and you portion out into little tubs, stack some of them up in the freezer. Like, you'll have more baller peeling a carrot and chopping a carrot and then trying to keep it fresh and stop it going black in the fridge or whatever, and then all you're doing is hindering yourself, you know what I mean? Meal prep, giving yourself time during the week, is actually cooking the stuff and having it ready, you know what I mean? Like trying to do mise en place for two or three dinners worth on one evening, I wouldn't be highly recommending that now, personally.
No, and I think if your knife skills are like super on point, it might make sense to do that, but it's probably a bit excessive. I don't think that's
I suppose someone probably just trying to make a ritual out of cooking,
that's good.
I do get it. I can see the frustration of chopping all the veg and then half an hour in and I've still nothing cooked.
The
other problem there is like all it's going to do is fuel the annoyance, because you find yourself now for an hour, let's just say hypothetically speaking, an hour and a half peeling carrots or chopping onions or crushing garlic, and that's all you've done. You've been an hour and a half in the kitchen and yet you're nowhere near a dinner.
Yeah.
And all it's doing is turning you off cooking.
Which is not positive. I mean?
It'll be very counterproductive, actually.
Yeah.
Okay, well, look, we'll have some crack with
it. Oh, man. Could have spoke to Willa for hours. Brilliant guy.
And mad into food, obviously. He's really into it.
Absolutely. Grub mad.
Yeah.
Like, every day is based on where he's staying. It's very funny when you see him and Jason Byrne coming out of, it's hilarious, like slating all these cafes, you know.
But I also think, and after speaking to a few people now, if there was any type of addiction in the past, food is just such an important part of, because it brings so much joy. And if you did have challenges with other things.
And he did have tough times, whatever, but he looks amazing. Brilliant guy. I can't wait to see Willa again, actually. I'm gonna manifest bumping into him again.
I'm sure you get an old game of golf in.
Actually, that's a good way. Yeah, I might just tap him up and get a few holes over at the K Club or
hopefully
something.
Hopefully him and Jason don't come into the cafe down the K Club.
Fucking stay away.
They tear shreds out of you. Yeah. They'd be like, how much for a bowl of chips?
They'll kill me.
Anyway, look, thanks as always for tuning in. We're back next week with more culinary conundrums, our dish of the week, and another great guest. If you can leave us a comment or review, please do, as it really helps us get more foodies listening. Chat to you next week.
Dishing It Out with Gary O'Hanlon and Gareth Mullins, a Go Loud original podcast.
Subscribe for free on the Go Loud app and never miss an episode.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us.